When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Welcome to Knife Talk. Just the two of us again this evening. Today it's myself and Mareko Marmassi of Marmassi Fire Arts, and myself, Craig Lockett of Chop Knives. Because our esteemed colleague, Jeffrey, is probably on a plane at the moment.
He's playing hooky.
Yes, again, yes. No, it looks as if he's had a great weekend, doesn't it?
It does. It's actually kind of painful to watch sometimes.
Yeah. So if you don't know, Jeff, who is normally with us every week, Jeff Fader of Fader Knives, he's been in Spain with Toma from Florentine Kitchen Knives, running a course there. And his Instagram, he's just been showing the food that they've been cooking and these amazing knives they've been making. Making me very jealous. So, Jeff, if you're on a plane and you're listening now, because I'd imagine you'd be listening on the plane because... You know, number one fan and all that. If it goes down, kiss your ass goodbye, basically. Hold tight if it gets bumpy.
I'll tell you, one of the craziest flights I ever had, I was sitting next to this giant human being. The guy was probably at least 6'8", and he was an older guy. Yeah. And I can't remember where I was going exactly. It might have been one of the first times I was going down to Blade Show, actually. Hmm. And they were going through, you know, in case of emergency, you know, buckle your seatbelts and all that shit. And, you know, if, you know, cabin pressure changes, they'll drop down the oxygen bag and make sure to, you know, take care of yourself first before you help somebody else. And as they're going through all of this, he leans over and he's like, you know, if any of that happens, we're fucking dead.
Exactly. We all think it, but telling a stranger is another thing.
Yeah, when I was like, I just started laughing. I was like, I think you're lucky that you're saying that to me, but because I take that in consideration every time I take a flight. Like, this could be the one. Yeah. This could be the last flight. Who fucking knows? But yeah, I think anybody else, a lot of other people, most people would probably get extremely nervous, and I just laugh.
Exactly, yeah. So, Jeff, if you are on a plane listening, I'm sure it'll be fine. I mean, statistically, it'll be fine.
Statistically, yeah. It's one of the safest forms.
It's always that one, isn't it?
Right.
Oh, geez. Anyway, Mareko, how has your week been?
The week's been good. I had a friend come into the shop, Karing Rakunin. He lives locally. He's actually one of my Patreon sponsors and members, and he has a background in video, and so he came down and he hung out in the shop and he took some video, and mostly I really appreciate his patience, but mostly he was just kind of like a human tripod. But he did also do a good job of helping kind of like bounce questions off of me and make some other maybe short form content. But I've been trying to get video of me forging an integral knife start to finish for a long time. Like a couple of years. I've been trying to get the footage on my own, and I get about halfway through and I'm so caught up with the forging that I forget about the camera. And then I'm basically the end of the forging and tuning everything up. I'm like, sweet, looks great. And I'm like, fuck, I forgot the camera. And I missed like the whole last, and I've tried it like 4 or 5 times. And I finally, the last time it happened, which was only a couple months ago, I was like, I need to get somebody else in here. So, I started talking to Kari about coming in and being in the shop with me while I was working and doing that. And it was great. And we had a great conversation. We got along great. We went for a delicious Vietnamese lunch afterwards. Giant short, he got the short rib pho, and it was just like this giant chunk of beautifully roasted short rib, like braised short rib in his pho cup. And, yeah, it was delicious. It was a great lunch.
So is this video for any sort of longer form content, or is it just for your socials?
Of it's going to be for socials. Some of it is going to be for longer form, kind of more instructional stuff that I've been trying to work on getting put together for my Patreon. I used to like play with the idea of having all these kind of standalone instructional videos that could be purchased and can kind of be evergreen as people evolve through their techniques and skills. And there's always going to be new makers and stuff like that. But having them available to purchase on my website, but to do all that and have somewhere, a website that's set up to host all that kind of footage and, you know, depending on the amount of hours and, that things get streamed. It's a lot of, and I was like, you know what? I think doing this through Patreon might be the easiest way. That way it's just there and you pay for a subscription to the Patreon and you have access to that stuff.
Do they host the video there too? Or is it going to be like a YouTube link from there or something?
Yeah. So they don't host there, but they have, they integrate very easily. And so I have a subscription through Vimeo. That's a bit more secure than like YouTube, and that way it's available on the Patreon through Vimeo, but you only have it there. You can't just like copy the link and then share it wherever, you know.
Gotcha, that makes sense, Cool. So when are people likely to be able to see any of this video, do you think?
Well, in the middle of August, I'm going to be traveling. I'm going back to the lake house on the island, Lake House. Nice. And we're going to be there for a week.
That sounds so cool. I'm going back to the lake house.
And it'll be fun. And my sister's actually going to be joining. She'll be up from New Orleans with her partner, Royal. And but that's when I'm going to have time to, because there's no shop, so I'll have a bit of downtime to kind of work on some of that video editing and stuff like that. And I'll still be able to record, so I won't disappear again.
Cool. Okay. No, that's all good. It's all good.
Yeah, but outside of that, I've just been, I'm working actually on a pair of knives right now. They're kind of a matching set. They're made from a new mosaic Damascus pattern. One is a giant slicer. It's like 11 and a half inches or something like that.
Oh, wow.
And then the other is a 8 3/4, I think about 240 millimeter chef's knife, European style chef's knife. And I just finished the finish grinding, which is always kind of, to me, that's like this signifier of the halfway point. And then now it's time for handle assembly and sculpting and da-da-da-da-da. So
cool.
Yeah.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Sounds like fun.
How's your week been? Have you been melting your ass off?
It's been hot again. So, sort of getting used to it now. But yeah, it's been hot. So again, very little time in the shop. So I've been working on some kitchen knives with, Juma handles. That synthetic. It's almost like a snake skin. It looks pretty cool.
Yeah. It looks like dragon skin. I love that.
Exactly. Yeah, dragon skin. That's better. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So that's quite nice. So Monday, Tuesday, I shall be sort of shaping that and polishing that and just seeing how they come up. So I'm looking forward to that. But we had a bit of a crisis talk, my wife and I, today, because... all good.
Okay.
This isn't any sort of relationship we're splitting up kind of thing.
Okay, I got a little worried there for a second.
No, not at all. So basically, she's been on maternity leave for months now.
Sure.
And in, I think, end of September, or beginning of September, rather, she goes back to work.
Okay.
I've been on paternity leave too, you know?
Right.
So come September, I need to be full-time again. And we're thinking, we've moved into this house. We haven't finished a space for either of us to work yet.
Okay.
So it's our work that obviously pays for the house. And it's like, we're ridiculous. We haven't got anywhere to work properly. So, you know, my sort of workshop is workable, but it's not how I want it. And, yeah, you know, as you'd be working from a kitchen table, which isn't ideal. And we're like, what could we do about that? What's, you know, and we thought, we were just looking online and we found like an airport hangar, like 10 minutes down the road from us, an old one disused. Oh my
God. Really?
And we're like, this would be like the most awesome sort of, like, I wouldn't say play area, but, you know, our adult sort of,
yeah,
she'd have her office there, I'd have my workshop, I could have a rehearsal space for the band. It's huge. It could all just be, everything set up, ready to go at all times.
I see. So you're wanting to put the knife shop there too?
Exactly, wow. Yes.
Okay.
And it's sort of 10 minutes down the road, so we're like...
Yeah, that's great. 10 minutes down the road is perfect.
Yeah. So we made an inquiry, and this evening now we've been thinking, okay, it's away from the house, which is good. Hopefully Buddy will have some sort of daycare as well.
Sure.
So we can both go there and work full time. Then we're like, oh, we'll be in the same building all day, every day, and come home and be with each other all day, every day. Is that a good thing? And we're like, yeah, we'll be in separate areas. So there's all these things now. We're trying to weigh up, is that a good idea? Or do we get something like a... finish my workshop here and get an office built in the garden for my wife.
Mm-hmm.
Or so we've got all these options. It's just like, oh man, it's daunting, you know, because it's obviously a lot of expense. You don't want to make the wrong decision.
Right.
But I love the idea of this big sort of lockup that we can just lock up. Everything can be there. And yeah, we're away from the house, and it's where we go to work 9 to 5, done. So who knows? That could be happening. Yeah, it'd be nice to think it would anyway.
Yeah,
who knows?
That separation is nice. I've found.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
I think a lot of, you know, for a lot of folks who make knives, especially if you're a hobbyist, you're just doing it out of your garage or something like that.
Mm.
And the extra expense of having a separate place is definitely something to take into consideration. And maybe that's not necessarily an option for folks. I'm lucky that I have a separate space, I feel like, because it is nice to have kind of like that separation. And Jeff has talked about this too, where he used to have his shop at his house. But it's close enough. It's separate now, but it's also still close enough that if you need to run over to the shop real quick, it's only, you know, 5-10 minutes down the road. For me, it's...
Which is handy. Yeah.
For me, it's, you know, with no traffic or mild traffic, it's, you know, 12-15 minutes down the road for me. And so if I need to run back to the shop for anything, it's not a big kick in the pants, but...
It's nice to just have
that space.
Yeah, my space has always been, I mean, before we moved here in the previous house, it was actually in the house. We had a shop front there, and that we converted that to a workshop.
Right.
Where I am now, it's in the barn, which is attached to the house. So even though it's not in the house this time, it's still close enough for me to be able to hear a baby crying and going, oh, no, I need to go back, and you know, all these things.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so there's going to be some sort of upheaval. We haven't decided which yet, but I do like the idea of having this big space, because we're always into new... My wife and I, we're terrible for new hobbies and things like that. And, like, she's like, I'd love to try, you know, turning, doing some pottery. And it was, we'd have space for that.
Yeah.
And we'd, you know, there's all this different stuff. So, we, you know, we'd it'd be basically just like a big makery. We could just go there and make stuff.
You're just
going
to turn it into a bar, and you're just going to start hosting shows and performances there. You're going to have a comedy
night. She did say there's no way you could do that. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I do like the idea as well. I mean, talking about that, I mean, we would have everything set up for rehearsals for the band as well. So we could just walk in, rehearse.
Yeah.
And even if I just wanted to practice at the moment, if I want to practice, it's setting everything. It's, you know, it's an hour setting everything up just to do a simple practice.
Sure.
So being able to do that would be so cool. But yeah, my workshop would be there, which would be the main thing. So yeah, who knows? Who knows? Over the next few days, we're going to have discussions and, you know, I'm sure we'll get prices back and then discover there's no way in the world we can do it. But it's a pipe dream at the moment.
Yeah.
Who knows?
What size? What's the airplane hangar size?
I think it is. Let me find out.
I'm ready for some conversions. I'll do some conversions from.
Yeah, it's like 300 square meters, something like that. It's huge. It's massive.
I gotcha.
Did you send it to me? No, I don't have it here. I think it's like 350 square meters, something like that.
Okay, but like,
which is,
but like, like, what are some length and width roughly? Is that 15 by
15? I don't know. I don't know, to be honest with you. I don't know. Don't know. I thought you'd send me the details. I don't have it here. No. I tell you what, I'm going to text her now. She's upstairs and she can send me the details. Send me the details of the hangar. There we go. Okay, and in the meantime, we shall hear from our sponsors.
Knife Talk is sponsored by Even Heat, the manufacturers of the finest heat treat ovens available. To find your next oven, go to evenheat-kiln.com.
And you know what I'm going to say. Don't go to Even Heat. Go to knifetalk.net/heat. Because that will take you to Soul Ceramics, who are an official distributor of Even Heat, and we'll get you a discount so that you'll have $75 off and free shipping in the US. But also, they've got some built, already specced out, ready to go on the shelf. So, yeah, knifetalk.net/heat, and I'll put that link down in the description. And yeah, you can get one within a week. How cool is that?
All right, so I just did some rough math. So if it is 15 meters by 20 meters, which is roughly 50 by 65 feet, that is well over 3,000. That's 3,250 square feet. That's a good amount of space. That's nice. How hot? Yeah. How tall are the ceilings?
No, it is huge. More than big enough to have a huge mezzanine and still have, lots of space.
Oh, man.
I've got it here. Let me open it up.
I love this dead air.
I know. It's me getting excited about an airport hangar. Who would have thought? Right, we'll come back to this. I'm trying to open it up. So, shall we do some questions?
Yeah. Is this going to be a blaze through questions episode since Jeff isn't here? Tough scenario.
We've got a bunch. Yeah, we do have a bunch. So, yeah. Let's just see how we go. The first is from George in California. And I believe his Instagram handle is Will Klein. Which is strange if his name's George, but hey. And he's contacted us via Instagram. We are Knife Talk Podcast. If you don't know, DM us your questions and we try our best for every Monday morning, to answer your questions. Okay. Hey guys, thanks for doing the show. It makes Monday mornings go by a little faster. I recently saw an Instagram reel of someone cleaning a carbide-toothed wood carving angle grinder attachment by burning off the sawdust resin buildup with a torch. I don't know what
it burns a matic.
Burns a matic torch, yeah. Okay. After I told them I thought it was a bad idea, they directed me to the manufacturer's website showing how to burn the residue to a hard char before wire brushing off. Besides letting people make their own mistakes, I thought it was inappropriate for a manufacturer to tell people to take a torch to a hardened steel tool that's going to spin at a couple of thousand RPM. I'm just wondering what insight you may have on this. Thank you for your time. Wow, so the manufacturers are given instructions to do that, to set a torch to steel wheel.
Yeah, I would be concerned, obviously, about the, how hot of a temperature. But if you could maybe bake it and make that resin more brittle, because it sounds like the goal is to make the whatever buildup on the carbide teeth brittle so that they're easier to clean off. It might be easier to do that in like an oven and just bake it at like 350 degrees or something like that. But yeah, to do it with a torch sounds a little bit sketchy because it's so easy to overshoot temperatures, right?
Great. Yeah. Well, it just sounds dangerous as hell. Dangerous as hell. I've got the dimensions of this hangar.
Okay, he's back.
It's in meters as well.
Okay.
36 meters by 10 meters.
36 by 10.
So what's that? 360 square meters.
Let's see. So 36 meters. Oops. Jesus Christ. I know how to push numbers. 36 meters is 118 feet by how much? 36 meters by what?
By 10 meters.
10 meters.
And it's 7.5 meters tall. Which is fucking huge.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a high ceiling. Yeah, so that's 32 feet by whatever the 36 was again. 118, so just under 120. And that's pretty damn massive.
Yeah. So there's plenty we could do in it, but yeah, I shall keep everybody posted on the hangar situation. But what's a Burns-O-Matic torch? Is that a brand name or something?
Yeah, it's just a brand name. It's a handheld propane torch. But the Burns-O-Matic is specifically like the sparking and starting system. And then you can also it has kind of like an adjust. You can adjust the propane feed to a bigger torch or a tip or a smaller torch tip.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, I've seen people do crazy things with angle grinders, and this is probably up there with them, I suppose. But yeah. Do you want to take the next one?
Yeah, I just was doing the math in feet, so that's just under 4,000 square feet.
Which is a very nice
size. Yeah, you guys could definitely be on opposite ends and have plenty of space.
And we can have a bar.
And you can, of course, you got to have the bar. But the bar's in the middle. That's where everybody meets. You meet in the middle.
Yes, exactly. That could be that. I'll meet you for lunch, I could say. There yes, exactly. There we go.
All right. This next one is from, oh, Jesus, I'm going to mess this up. Naren McFun. I almost said Fondle. Fondled.
Fondled McDonald, I think.
Fondled McDonald.
Naren McFondle, I think it McFondled. Is, yeah.
Naren McFondle. Okay, question. I've got an LB22 from Even Heat, and it's probably a bit too big. Excuse me. But I'd rather have the space and not always need it than to need it and not have the space. I was wondering if it's possible to leave a soft brick or two in the back of the oven so that they create a thermal mass for when I'm using the oven to thermal cycle knives. Jesus. Thermal cycle knives that are mostly 12 to 14 inches total. It seems to take quite a bit of time to recover the heat loss when I'm opening and closing the door as quick as possible. But I'm usually doing 5 to 6 knives, so I gotta open and close 5 to 6 times. So it sounds like he's working in batches and he's struggling with the heat loss. Every time he's opening the door for, 5 to 6 knives. Do you think it makes sense to throw a couple bricks in the back? Excuse me, in the back for...
It's not going to do any harm, is it? Not going to do any harm. I mean, because that LB22, is super long, isn't it? So he's got all this space at the back. Right. And that's obviously just full of air. So when a door opens, it's, I stick a few bricks in there. It's certainly not going to do any harm.
Yeah.
And give the guys a ring at Even Heat. They give you some advice. You may even get some nice matching bricks so you don't have that horrible, mismatch of color, if that bothers you. It would bother me if it bothers
Look
you
Look at those
too.
Ugly bricks. They don't even match.
The original Even Heat bricks. But I can't see any harm in it. I think it's probably going to do a good thing for you. If unsure, that the guys at Even Heat are great, honestly.
For sure.
Give them a call and they could help you out and talk you through it. But it sounds like a good idea to me. You're taking less air out of it, and it's obviously the air that's cooling.
Right.
And you're having this big extra thermal mass, which is going to hold heat. So yeah, it sounds like a good idea to me.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a good idea to me too. Especially if you have, your blades are a maximum of around 14 inches, then that means you got like an extra 8 inches at the back of the forge or the kiln that is just dead space. Why not? And I think,
It's not going to be dangerous. Nothing bad can happen, I don't think.
Right.
So you should be good.
For sure.
As long as you are using good fire bricks and not just like normal.
Yeah, don't just use fireplace bricks. And then I think the heat loss from opening the door, it's just part of it. You just got to account for that.
And I always think with that as well, because the knives have got a mass themselves. So let's say you're doing 5 or 6 knives. So let's say, you've got 3 knives left in there. Those knives are holding a mass themselves. Mm-hmm. And the temperature reading that you're seeing is from the thermocouple, which is at the top there. So that thermocouple, that may be losing the heat, but obviously all the bricks around it and stuff and in the oven naturally anyway.
For sure.
Are going to hold more heat. So I wouldn't necessarily that the knives are dropping in temperature. Just the thermocouple, which is probably going to be the first thing that's going to drop temperature anyway. So I wouldn't worry too much.
Yeah.
Okay. Another word from one of our sponsors.
Combat Abrasives makes the world's best abrasive belts for knife makers. Available in any size at unbelievable prices. Go take a look at combatabrasives.com and get 15% off with promo code KNIFETALK15. Do it now.
do it now, indeed. And if you're in Canada, we can also you can also get your combat abrasives from maritimeknifesupply.com because they are distributors of combat abrasives too. So just because you're in Canada, don't think you're not getting all the deals that they get in the US. Head on over to maritimeknifesupply.com. They've got deals if you buy 10 or more belts, that kind of thing. And they've got loads of stuff. They're a one-stop shop for knife makers with steel, belts, handle materials, tools, like everything you need. Go take a look. They're also Maritime Knife Supply on Instagram. Lawrence is a good dude, so go take a look at what nice. They got.
I'm super thankful I got those ceramic shredders from Combat because I just got a chunk. I got a chunk of the new Apex Ultra, and I forged an integral blade out of it. And they're going to really come in handy in grinding that steel because I think it's going to be relatively wear resistant, and I know that it makes a difference using those belts versus other belts. I just like in my experience with like high wear resistant steels like W2 and Crewforge V, those extra carbide forming elements make that steel so much more wear resistant, and that those shredders really just tear through the material. But shout out to Laren Thomas and Mark Goldman and Tobias Hangler for making this killer steel. So far, it was challenging to forge, but not much more challenging than 52-100, and I'm excited to see how it heat treats and grinds afterwards.
So what's the deal with this Apex steel? How is it different from a 52-100, for example?
Yeah, there aren't really a lot, or I guess more so nowadays, there are steels that are specifically manufactured for knives, and these guys were wanting to create a steel that is, and I wish Laren was on here to better describe it, but anyways, wanting to create a steel for forgers that takes a higher hardness, but also has a higher toughness. And some of that is just in the type of carbides that are formed and the size of the grain. And so also trying to add elements that help restrict grain growth. And I think they were getting, Laren was getting on his Knife Steel Nerds blog, he talks about getting the highest toughness that he's ever achieved from a super high hardness, like 66 to 68 Rockwell blade. And so the goal is, especially for knives that aren't hard use, like a chef's knife, like that's great to be able to have a higher hardness because that just means the blade's going to hold the edge better. And because of the particular carbide forming elements they have in the steel, carbides are going to be much smaller, the grains are going to be much tighter and smaller, and so that lends to also better toughness at the higher hardness. So you can basically just create a higher performance high carbon steel blade. So I'm excited to like I said, put it through the rest of the heat treating and finish grinding so I can then basically just beat the shit out of it and see what happens. So I'll probably have about a solid, you know, 6 to 8 hours in this thing, and then I'm basically gonna destroy it and see what happens.
Oh wow, okay. You know, we need to get Laren back on again because last time we had so many questions specifically for him.
Oh, for sure.
So I think it would be a good idea, and the second best doctor we've ever had on the show, after Dr. Chris.
And his tits.
What have we got here? Carl Hancock says, where are some characteristics of ideal customers? How much involvement do you like from customers, and when does this start to be too much? I'm a non-bladesmith that likes to support makers. Some seem to want lots of details, some of which I don't quite even understand, and others just want you to trust them to make a good product. Any insights would be appreciated. I enjoy the show. So Carl's not a maker. He just likes to support makers, and obviously he's a fan of knives.
Thank you for your support, Carl.
Yes, what is the ideal customer? Is it somebody who comes to you with a full idea of what they want? Is it somebody who comes to you saying, you know, what could you make me? And you've got to describe everything to them. What would be your ideal customer, Marco?
I mean, I think the biggest challenges I've had with customers are people coming to me to make stuff that I just don't make. And I think that is one of the struggles for makers when people reach out to them and saying, I want something built, is they think that we all have the same set of skills when we all have a very particular set of skills. Yeah, I think being aware of what that maker actually does is really important and will also help you make a better informed decision as to who you either work with or what you get from that particular maker. But other than that, I think also just like from maker to maker, it's going to vary, you know, how much input they want versus how much they don't want. And that also depends on their business model. Maybe their business models, they don't take custom orders and you just get what you get. Or they have a very specific regimen of knives that they are opening orders to. But again, you're not, you know, really doing a lot of customer feedback about what specific handle material or bevel grind or any kind of that stuff or accenting materials. You're just, you know, versus there are people who, and the way I used to do things is I would give people the full rein of, you know, the blade length and the heel height and the Damascus pattern and what kind of grind and handle material and the handle style and all that stuff. And I honestly feel like that is a thing that some people really excel at and are capable of doing very comfortably. I did it for a long time, but it took me a long time to realize that that is not where my strengths lie. And I struggle with it a lot because, you know, just little like mistakes and stuff happen. But for me, It was constantly setting me back, and that extra pressure that was resulting from that was too much. And so that's why I changed things. But I think it's just going to vary from person to person what they're willing to do.
I still get a lot of inquiries asking me to make something specific and, you know, could you forge this? And then it's just like they clearly haven't seen my style of work, you know? Like you said, you know the maker if you're contacting them to, you know, have something specific. You know that's the kind of thing that they do. Because, yeah, I'd probably say 25-35% of the inquiries that come my way are just not the style that I've ever done and would do, you know?
So, for sure.
Yeah, but most of my customers are sort of restaurants, and what I tend to do with them is I give them like a 3D model of what it'll be, showing the handle material, the exact shape, size, and things like that. So they can visualize it completely, and I've got a system set up so I can make one of them within sort of 10 minutes because I've got templates and I can just bang in, you know, the handle materials and so on. It'll make them really quickly, and I find that really great for the customers to know exactly what they're having. How it's going to look, and you know, if they want any suggestions, we can change that really quickly. And again, they've got this 3D render again, so they can see it. It tends to work really well. But obviously, if you're just doing one-offs, that's, you know, it's a lot of time involved in that. So that probably wouldn't work so much. But from a customer point of view, I think if you're reaching out to a maker, at least know, you know, their style and, you know, have a reason for contacting that person. Because if not, if you just contact a maker and say, could you make this specifically for me? I get the feeling they're probably contacting a bunch of makers and seeing what prices are coming back.
Sure, they're just blanketing.
Exactly, yeah. Field. And and you can tell with some emails they come in, you know exactly what they're doing. It's just like, this is not going to work so well. But yeah.
All right, we got another one here from Benjamin Coffin. Oh, wait, that's Benjamin Coffin. He says, just made my first Damascus blade, wrapped it in blue painter's tape to finish the handle, took the tape off, and noticed... tape residue. Took big fat fingernail to get it off, and then it fucked up the coffee etch contrast. Went from black to gray. What could I have done or not done? Thanks for any advice. I'll start that one off. So it sounds like he just threw tape straight onto the blade. Something that is a common practice, like you can buy shrink wrap, like in short rolls of maybe like 4 inches wide or 6 inches wide, or even just saran wrap, you know, for your kitchen. But putting something on, or even a paper towel, honestly, for protecting the blade and then then wrapping up the blade after that, is a pretty common move for folks. If you're trying to, like, I used to do a lot more buffing work, and when I was trying to buff kind of the transition from the wood to the Damascus, and I didn't want the Damascus to get buffed on, I would use painter's tape, but I would also put just a little bit of wax around that area where the painter's tape was going to go on at that transition, and that would one, it would get buffed off in the buffer, so I wasn't too worried about it. But it would also make it so that the painter's tape would come off a little bit easier without adhering to any of the surface finish and potentially peel it out, because I have done that. I've seen that happen, and it is frustrating. But yeah, using some sort of shrink wrap or paper towel, or even, I don't use painter's tape as much anymore. I use, usually I'm using electrical tape. And I find that I have less issues with electrical tape on my Damascus rather than the painter's tape. Because even though painter's tape is designed to easily come off, it is still quite tacky. And so, yeah, those have been my moves, my go-to moves for stuff like that.
There you go. Can't beat that. Okay. J-Mod Knives. Okay, I've got a dilemma. He says, right now I'm in Arizona. My shop is anywhere between 115 and 130 degrees at all times. I've just done a quick conversion. That's 54 degrees Celsius.
Yowza.
Fuck.
It's hot.
That is ridiculous. And I thought we were getting hot at 40 degrees. Right. Jesus Christ. He said, I'd get up before the sun came out around 3 or 4 when it's nicest out, but that would disrupt my lady's schedule, as the anvil is about 15 feet away from the bedroom window. I've been dunking shirts in a cooler full of ice and draping it over me to keep cool.
Wow.
But I'm thinking about getting some misters for the outside section of the shop, because that's probably all I can afford at the moment.
Yeah.
But I'm afraid of it rusting out my tools because everything is really tight under this shade structure. Just lost on how to get anything done when battling this intense heat. Fuck, I feel for you. Jesus Christ, that is hot. And you can't do anything in the night because your anvil's 15 feet away from the bedroom window. There's the old Australian trick of the silver spoon on the nuts, which we've talked about in the past.
Maybe you could freeze a pair of underwear too.
Yes, yeah. A mister. I mean, yeah, if that's all over your tools and stuff, they're gonna start rusting, particularly if it's like really humid and stuff as well.
Right.
And you're sweating, there's salt everywhere. Oh, man. I don't know what to suggest. I mean, cover up all the windows. Don't let any heat in the first place. I suppose is all you can do. I don't know. I feel for you.
Yeah, I don't have a very good air conditioning setup in my shop, and I think for most anybody they don't, because usually it's just a large open space. If somehow you have a small area though, that is like maybe your office, or even like if it's not far from the house, even just being able to step into the house into some sort of air conditioned space, I found really made a huge difference for me. I've never worked in that kind of heat, but I've worked in high, like when I was in Connecticut at Dragon's Breath, the shop would get extremely hot, easily into the 90s throughout the summertime from time to time. Mm. But the humidity there was also just horrendous, and I could be standing in the shop literally doing nothing, talking or whatever with one of the other guys, and be sweating my absolute ass off, and it was not awesome. But we always had a tiny little like office space that was maybe like 200 square feet that we kept air conditioned, and so being able to have something like that to step out of the hot shop and into made such a big difference. And if I had to stay in that all day long, I don't know. Maybe I'm being a little bitch, but there's no way I could be doing. I can't work.
Yeah, it can't be healthy. So obviously, make sure you're hydrated and so on. Yeah. But yeah, you're right. Have a space where you can go just to cool down when you do feel it. Sure. You know, at its worst. But
And not using a mister, I think, is a good move. But I think you could still get a spray bottle and just spray like water on your skin. Because the energy required to make that water evaporate off of your body, I mean, and this is part of your body's natural cooling system, right, is you sweat. If you're spraying water onto your skin, it's kind of replicating what's already happening with the sweating, but having air circulating, either having a fan, even if it's blowing hot air, that fan blowing across that water or your sweat is drawing energy, helping to dry that water off, which pulls heat energy out of your body and helps cool you off effectively. And that is why we sweat. So even just having a spray bottle handy that you can spray yourself with, and some airflow of some sort, either in your grinding room when you're, you know, cycling air out, or just having a stand-up fan that you can step in front of. Actually, my buddy Will Brigham has a he's a swamp cooler. They are a bit of an investment. They're like $500 to $600 at the base, and that's only supposed to be for a quote unquote 500 square foot space. But Will's shop is like 1,000 square feet. But what he really does is he has it in front of wherever he's working. So he's not necessarily trying to cool down the whole space. He's just trying to have cold air that can blow across him to help cool off during those hot days, because he definitely gets some heat down there. And like
what you said, a swamp cooler. What is it? It's just a fan, is it?
I assume. Yeah, it's like a giant air conditioning, but it's some. I don't know exactly how swamp coolers work, but basically it's cycling water across the air and it's pulling air in across like this water screen, and then it cycles it through and it cools it off before it then blows it and expels it back out. Basically, like an air conditioner in a way. I think the difference is an air conditioner pulls moisture out of the air and then does that process, versus a swamp cooler, water is actively pushed through the machine to help cool the air and then cycle it through the shop. While those are a big investment in that kind of heat, like, it might be worth it, because that is gnarly.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big money on new windows now at Menards. Update your home with vinyl windows from Jeld-Wen. They're durable, energy efficient, and are low maintenance. Menards carries over 100 different size and style options in stock, ready to take home today. Save big on Jeld-Wen windows in store, or view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more window deals happening this week. Now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Yeah.
Okay. J-Mod is Jeff's buddy, by the way, who I think Jeff just got a skateboard from J-Mod, didn't he?
He did, yes. Apparently so, yes. Yeah. But wow, yeah. Stay careful in that heat. Jesus, I'm sweating just thinking of it. Jesus, yeah. 54 degrees Celsius, that's... Whew. Anyway, Thirsty Work Industries, which is a good name, said, "Hi, fellas. I've got a question. I've been hearing an increasing number of makers briefly mention their tapered tangs. After doing one of my own, I found out what a massive pain in the ass it was, but I didn't notice any real benefits. Am I missing something? Or is it talking about your tapered tang, the name dropping of the knife world?" Yeah, I'm sort of with you. There's arguments for it. Well, first of all, aesthetically, I suppose it shows a skill. There's obviously a weight relief in there as well. But I think if it's weight relief, you could also sort of skeletonize that tang anyway and take the weight out that way. I think they can look cool, but it's maybe a bit of a flex, you know? I don't think there's any benefit to it apart from looking, you know, aesthetically cool.
Yeah, I think... I feel like I heard somebody talking about how it does lend a little bit more strength, especially in prying. But I can't remember exactly the argument or the theory. But I do think, like you were saying, it is aesthetically, it is a nice look. And it does help, kind of reduce weight. And that might be more, necessarily, especially in large, heavy knives. I don't know. I think it is, it's more of an aesthetic, than really necessary. Because obviously, you know, if you really wanted to lose weight in a knife, you would do a hidden tang, basically, right? And that would just get rid of tons of material in the tang area. So I think it's just a stylistic choice, and I don't think there's anything wrong. I mean, so many things in the knife making industry are a flex, right? Like even just forging an integral, like that's 100% a flex. It, you know, making the knife out of Damascus or mosaic Damascus, even all of that's a flex, and all of that it's supposed to be like a flex or a visual representation of a maker's particular level of skill or whatever. But
it's not
necessary.
Let me give everybody a top tip: if you want to flex, you could always just buy in your Damascus if it's stainless as well. It could be the best stuff out there, which is Dharma Steel. If you go to dharmasteel.se, you'll see the patterns that they've got. Beautiful, beautiful patterns. You sort of buy it by the inch. Really special stuff. People use it to make jewelry, all sorts of lovely stuff. Go take a look at dharmasteel.se. If you register, you'll then get the pricing. If you use Knife Talk, you'll get 10% off that pricing too. And we're hoping to be working with them again very soon on their Chef Invitational event, which they do. They do loads for the community, knife making community. They're great, great people. So hopefully we can work with them again to do that. But go take a look at dharmasteel.se. And if you look at Dharma Steel Lab on Instagram, you'll see the kind of stuff that people are making with Dharma Steel. Super, super high-end stuff. Super flex, man.
Yeah, you want to really flex? Get some Dharma Steel and forge an integral out of that. Wow, yeah. This is a fucking nightmare.
High level flex.
I actually have some of their, what is it, they sent us that sand mine material, right? I have it, it's still in bar form, but my plan is to cut it up and forge I think 3 different knives out of that one bar, just as a kind of a, a flex.
Just to do it.
Who else is doing this? That's right, basically nobody.
Exactly. Very nice. Very nice. Okay. Eben Blades sent a question. Again, via Instagram. Question for you. I just got my first buyer for a knife, and they asked how much. I'm super critical of my work and don't think it's good enough, so I told them an X amount, thinking they'd walk away. But they accepted. The bastard. I've just read the next line.
Oh, boy.
He says, should I just pull a Craig and take their money if they're that interested? Or am I hurting myself for lowballing a price because I'm super critical of my work? It's so when you start out, it's so difficult pricing your work, because realistically, if you priced it for the amount of time that you put in, you wouldn't get any customers as a new maker, because you're still developing those skills and it takes so much time. So it is such a hard thing. But if they've agreed to the price, pull a Craig, as you say, and take their money. They've agreed to that price and they know what they're getting. I assume they've seen your work, or they've at least seen pictures of your work, if they're agreeing to buy. But that whole thing about being super critical of your work, I think that's a good thing. Don't get yourself down about that. That's a good thing. And if people are willing to pay you money for your knives, that's how we all started. That's how we all do it. We start making a few knives and people want to start buying them, and that's how it works. So yeah, go for it. So you say, am I hurting myself for lowballing a price, because I'm super critical of my work? You say this is your first buyer. So this whole lowballing thing, unfortunately, you're going to be, because like I said, you put a lot of time and effort into this. And until you can make that work for you economically, you're always going to be lowballing on your first knives that you sell, unfortunately. But if they're happy and you're happy enough to, move on, make the next knife, which is going to be better, and maybe next time the price can go up a little bit as well, eventually you come to that point where you're making a profit with each knife, and that's the name of the game.
Yeah, I think that's kind of, I'm right there with you. You kind of have to start low. And you just kind of, when you feel more confident about your skills, you kind of start pushing the price up. Maybe it's only $50 at a time or something like that, or 100, whatever. But just kind of, you figure out, eventually you get to a point where fewer people are interested in buying your work at a certain price point. And that's kind of where, like, that's your own, what is that called? It's market research, I guess, in a way, where you're kind of just testing what people are willing to pay. But I feel like a pretty sweet spot that, especially when it comes to custom knives, that there's a large number of people willing to spend money is between, you know, that $350, $400 at the low end and like $1,000 at the high end. Once you start getting outside of that, especially on the top end, you drop down exponentially to how many people are willing to spend that kind of money.
And their expectation will rise.
100. Well, yeah. And,
crazily too.
Yeah. And people are, you know, they're usually a bit more educated about what goes into a really high quality, high performance. Cause usually, yeah, like you said, that's what they're looking for. Their expectations are a lot higher. And so the price point should reflect also kind of like, yeah, the quality of the manufacturing or the, you know, the maker skills and how well that thing actually performs. Because, you know, there are people out there who are trading on brand, but not necessarily making great tools. And I don't know, for me, I couldn't do that. That's also like me struggling with, I don't know if it's an artist mindset or something like that, or I don't know, whatever, but you know, there are people, if you can make the money, then make the money. But how long you're going to be able to do that, especially if people are feeling kind of like they're being kind of screwed over. They're paying good money, good hard-earned money. They expect something, and then they're not getting that. Like, that's not going to bode well over the long term.
But hey, congratulations, Eben Blades. Yeah. You've got your first sale anyway, so you know, you're on your way. You're on your way. Yes.
All right. Excuse me. We got a question from Austin Caraccio. Sorry, Austin. He said, first off, he starts off with a misspelling. He says, "Yo, balls," like he's talking to our balls. I think he's meant boys, but maybe he means balls. I don't know.
Maybe he means balls. I think maybe Jeff has put a couple of these in the notes to trip us up.
I got you. Motherfucker.
Yeah.
He says, "I have a fully outfitted shop in the industrial park here in South Jersey."
Ooh.
I know, big one. My day job as an assistant superintendent of a private country club doesn't allow me, allow me to fully utilize my shop this time of year. What are your opinions on renting a small space to a maker and allowing use of the larger equipment included? I own the 2,000 square foot building. So any extra source of income is welcome. Cheers, y'all. Also, Austin says, if yes, what's the best way to find a competent renter that won't burn the joint down? I think, Austin, that is the big question.
That's the big question, yeah. We've had a lot of this question from the other side of things, where people are looking, they can't find a place for love nor money.
Sure.
They've been looking for a place, and a lot of it is down to them. When they speak to renters, they say, "Oh, the insurance, it'll be a nightmare, you know, having you in, you know, you're a knife maker or whatever you are, you know, it'd be difficult for me." But it's interesting that you're coming from the other side. You've got the space. So you need to find out the insurance, I suppose, really, and see how, and then, you know, cost things out and see whether it's feasible for anybody to use that space.
Yep. I mean, I think that is definitely the way to do it. If your insurance will cover it, then, and then, you know, obviously accumulating everything again would be a huge pain in the ass. And so taking that also into consideration, I mean, maybe you're better off just leaving it empty. But I will say that if it wasn't for somebody being willing to open their shop out, to me, I would not have gotten started. I didn't have any tools, equipment, or extra money. I was pseudo homeless when I first started knife making on my own. 9 years ago now. I was surfing couches. I just moved back from Denver. I didn't have a very solid situation of any kind. And but I knew I wanted to get back into knife making, and so I got a hold of a knife maker that I knew who had excess space. So he had his own full blacksmithing and knife working shop. And then next door in this industrial building, he had an extra shop that was a school. But the school sat empty for most of the month, except for a couple, like 2 or 3 day classes that he might run throughout the month. But otherwise it sat empty. And that was an opportunity for me. I saw it as an opportunity for me to make use of those tools and kind of basically get my start, kind of like an incubator, actually, kind of in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. And was he on site there as well in his shop next door?
Yes. 100%. Right, okay. So yeah. I was only in there when he was able to be in there at the same time. And so if there were any struggles or any issues, he was able to jump right over and help with anything I might be having a hard time with. Fortunately, nothing happened. I think the only time something actually, like the fire system got kicked off, I wasn't even doing the work. Somebody else was doing some torch work, on that school side, and they pointed the torch up straight at one of the fire sprinklers and it kicked off was like, it's like a 12,000 square foot building with a massive
and they
fire
all went off.
Yeah. I mean, most of the stuff in that specific area went off. The whole building didn't go off, but even that alone, it cost like $20,000 or something to get things reset and to pay for the fire department showing up and all that shit. But that is stuff that
happen in the U.S. Do you, when the fire service are called out, do you need to pay for that service?
Yeah.
Fuck. Yeah. Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So Austin, yes, if you're getting people in, they need to be obviously experienced, because if you're not going to be there and they're using your equipment, there's, you know, first of all, it's dangerous, physically dangerous to them, but obviously the harm that they could do to your equipment and the building as well.
Yeah, trusting somebody else in your shop, that would be very difficult for me to accomplish. I think even when I was working for Bob Kramer, it was probably like 2 years or a year and a half before he felt comfortable with me being in the shop working by myself while he was, you know, out, you know, going to Blade Show and stuff like that. Right. So it definitely takes time to earn that trust, but that means you got to be there, which kind of defeats the whole purpose of renting it out. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe if Austin, we don't know where you're from. It sounds like an Italian name, doesn't it? Caruccioglio or something. I don't know. But if anybody knows Austin, he's got some space. Maybe you could work something out. Okay. Crow's Skull Forge. I like this one. What is your guy's guilty pleasure about knife making? He says, with me, it's the smell of a new batch of grinding belts.
Ugh.
Yeah, it's not the nicest smell, but whatever turns you on. Guilty pleasure. I don't suppose it's a guilty... I mean, I don't think anything is a guilty pleasure. If you take pleasure in it, good for you. But I personally, I like... Because I do full-tang blades. And when you you put your handles on and you put your pins through and stuff like that, and you obviously let it dry off, that stroke with the grinder, when you reveal the tang again and you see that lovely defined line where you've got some liners and you've got your handle material... That for me is a big sort of payoff, I think, of all the work. You think, you can see how this is going to look properly now. For me, that's always like a massive pleasure. That bit, it's a big, it's a big payoff for everything that you do.
I mean, I think a guilty pleasure is something you take pleasure in, but you're not necessarily excited to admit to anybody about, right?
Yeah, like a dirty little secret.
What's your dirty little secret that you love about knife making? Oh boy, I'm trying to think. I can't think of anything off the top of my head. The only thing I could potentially think of is like there are a lot of makers who love to just wait until the very end to etch a knife, especially if they made it out of Damascus, to see what things look like. But I never wait. That's something I can never wait for. It's like waiting for Christmas kind of presents.
Etch multiple times through the process, don't
you? For sure, constantly. Because also the pattern sometimes changes throughout the making process, from the forging to the primary grinding to the finish grinding, and even after hand sanding, if there are some things that can change still. And so I'm constantly etching and looking at it to see what things are looking like. Because again, especially when I was doing full custom stuff, the pattern was a specifically requested thing. And if it wasn't looking right, then I needed to stop and start over, or set it, you know, put that customer's order aside and finish out this project, and that before going back and starting over on theirs and all that kind of stuff. So it was kind of more out of necessity that I was constantly, but I, even still now, when things aren't, you know, necessary, I can just make kind of whatever I want. I still relish that first look at the Damascus pattern, especially after it was forged into a blade shape.
Nice. Why don't you tell everybody about your grinder? I'm sure that gives you lots of pleasure.
I love my Broadbeck grinder. It's a great grinder. It is basically the Swiss Army knife of the knife making industry. It's so handy, and it's, you know, 6 or 7 machines in one, really, from a surface grinder to a buffing machine to a disc grinder to a, you know, the slack platen, hard platen, all the different shit in between, small wheel attachment, slack belt. It's got so much going on for it. And if you go to BroadbeckIronworks.com at checkout, if you put in Knife Talk in, you will get a automatically updated or upgraded to the Marecco platen, which is the deep throated platen that allows for a lot of room and movement of your handle or your blade when you're doing, especially when you're doing your handle sculpting. It's a project that Broadbeck and I worked together on to create greater ease of movement and flexibility and just being able to work symmetrically around a platen. And it came out great, and I've heard nothing but positive feedback from folks. But yeah, it's a really handy and super versatile machine. It's even light enough. Like I've been doing the knife sharpening recently that I haul it around with me, but I do know that they have a new sharpening system, which I need to, maybe talk to them about, because hauling that grinder around isn't light. You know, it's probably like 60 pounds or something like that. So they also offer, they got the sharpening machine. They also have, they sell, what is it? The leather sewing machines, right?
Yeah. So if you're making sheaths out there, they got the, I think it's the cowboy machine or something it's called, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So Broadbeck, they're trying to take care of us as knife makers. And even if you already have your own chassis and setup, you can still use their tool arms. Their tool arms are designed to be used cross-platform, which is really handy and flexible. And they make some really, really great tool arms, especially that Marecco platen.
I mean, they're knife makers themselves. They know what we Absolutely. Need. They're good guys. Good guys. Okay, Paul Jansen. I guess you could call this unsolicited advice, but it's more of a total stranger asking for a favor. He says, Craig talked about trying not to waste food, and Jeff has a video of cooking the oysters. And it got me thinking about the disconnect and disrespect most consumers have with the food they eat. He's a 6th-generation farmer, and talking to the public makes him cringe when you hear they actually believe food comes from the store and not a farm.
Jesus.
He says, you all work with the culinary industry and have a better understanding than most about where food actually comes from, and have a much bigger following than I do. But using that platform to remind people not to waste food and encouraging people to understand where food actually comes from would go a long way in helping bridge the gap. Most people don't realize that everything we eat was once alive, and it made a sacrifice so that we can live. Don't need all the Peter bullshit with that, but I'm not wasting the food. That is a good way to show respect for plants and animals that we eat. He said, that's my 2 cents for whatever they're worth. I'll have to try the oyster recipe if I can ever find fresh oysters in the middle of Kansas. Yeah, that has got to be, I mean, he says he's a sixth generation farmer. That has got to be such a thing, you know, hearing people, you know, well, they're wasting food and just talking about food as this sort of commodity and all the rest of it, you know, when, you know, he sees the amount of work that goes into putting, you know, food on a plate. Yeah, a lot of respect for farmers and that's those sort of industries.
Yeah, man, it's hard work. And it does, it shocks me too, like how little people understand about where the food actually comes from. I think something that has really helped me to have a greater appreciation has been learning how to fish and farm for my own, or not farm, but forage for my own food. So taking my kid out and walking, like hiking through the woods for a couple hours just to find a couple pounds of mushrooms or something like that, right?
Mm. Yeah, exactly. That little nuggets, that is gold, it's treasure, right? Yeah.
Or driving out to the beach and, you know, digging up my own razor clams and spending a couple hours doing that just for, you know, one meal's worth of razor clams, you know. But the way I feel about that food is completely different than something from the store. And I do think that because of us, you know, you, me, and Jeff, with our appreciation and understanding of preparation of food and our love for cooking food, we do have a better understanding of where it's coming from. And I think that's part of the reason that we make the culinary knives that we do make, is because they're an extension of one of our hobbies and our passions, is to, you know, take care of the ones we love by creating delicious food for them to eat and enjoy and share together.
Yeah. So Paul, thank you for your service. Genuinely, I mean that. Do you want to take the next one from Jay Daler?
Yeah. Jay Daler. He says, any tips for hand sanding blocks? Of course the best is to use RhinoWet, but should they be backed with leather or rubber or left flat, made of wood, G10 or metal, handles or no handles? So he's got questions about hand sanding blocks or hand sanding sticks, and what to use and how to use them.
I use G10 cutoffs. I'll get like a 6mm or quarter inch slabs of G10 and cut in strips. And I just use that. I've always got lots in the shop. Always works well. What I tend to find then is when I get to the sort of the lower grits and I'm doing sort of final polishing almost, I've got a couple where I've just put some leather strips on.
Nice.
And that just softens it slightly and takes away any of those. You know, sometimes you get those hard grit lines. You might get one or two, sure. You know, and they take a long time to come out. So you just sort of feather them out then with using the leather. But I don't think it makes too much of a difference what material you're using. As long as it's flat, it should do the job. I know a lot of people use sort of aluminium blocks.
Sure.
But I think as long as it's flat, you should be good.
Yeah, I like using, I have a flat hand sanding stick, but I almost never use it, or I hardly use it. If I use it for anything, it is just for the bolster transition from the integral bolster down into the blade, or on facets around, or flat areas around the bolster. And I guess also along the spine and at the back, at the heel or at the choil of the knife. But otherwise, when I'm hand sanding and doing the bulk of the hand sanding of my blade, I actually use a curved hand sanding stick. And part of that is because I almost all my knives these days have an S grind, so they have a hollow in the blade that I'm trying to get inside of and sand out. But the curvature of my hand sanding stick is actually tighter than the hollow that I'm trying to hand sand, and that is so that I'm actually my hand sanding, the surface that I'm actually sanding with is about 7/8 of an inch wide by 3 inches long. And so I have bunch of little strips of sandpaper. I take my RhinoWet and a paper, like an old school paper cutter, and I just chop it all down to fit that size. But that way, when I'm hand sanding, I can focus that force. Instead of focusing the hand sanding force across the entire face of that 3 inches wide sandpaper, it's only actually maybe 3/4 of an inch or an inch that's actually engaged with the blade at a time. And that way I can also kind of either do localized sanding in just one little spot rather than having to hit the whole thing. But I also get to, it helps focus that force so that I feel like I'm getting kind of like more work done, honestly, and can hand sand more aggressively than I could if it actually fit that exact curvature. My hand sanding sticks are just made out of scrap 2x4 or hickory that I've had laying around, and I usually like the back, at least my quote unquote hard hand sanding stick, with like a dense rubber gasket. You can find them at hardware stores. They're usually like in the plumbing section. You can get like a 6-inch by 6-inch gasket of rubber that you can, that I think you're designed, that are designed for you to like custom cut out or whatever. You could probably also get them from like a automotive shop too. And then, but it depends on the stick. So both the flat stick and the hollow hand sanding stick have that rubber gasket. But the I do the same thing as Craig, actually, who's just saying he when you go to the finish strokes, I have a secondary curved hand sanding stick that has leather on it, so that it does help just kind of soften and those hand sanding pulls, those strokes, so that instead of really shoving the abrasive into the surface, it's more passively abrading the surface and helps you get more of a satin aesthetic on the blade.
Yeah, it sort of mellows things out
for
a bit,
sure.
It?
Yeah. It's beautiful. Yeah. And I've also actually been finding, especially when I'm preparing for etching Damascus, whether it's in ferric or in coffee, finishing with those finishing strokes with a leather-backed sandpaper actually open up the surface so that it etches more cleanly and readily than if I had a hard backing. I've found that when the abrasive, as it breaks down, instead of actually cutting, it's more kind of smearing the surface, which is called burnishing. And when I go into either the ferric or my coffee or whatever, after that, I get all kinds of weird shit starts happening to the steel. Especially on the 15 and 20, where the 15 and 20 like starts to pick up color. But I find that if I use that softer backing with the leather and I pull like 800 grit or 600 grit strokes, that opens up the surface in a way that it helps it etch more effectively. And it actually, it seems counterintuitive, but the 15 and 20 stays clean better by having a more open surface rather than a polished or smudged or burnished surface. I get better etching results that way.
There we go. So remember, kids, the leather for those final strokes. Yeah. But anyway, you're using RhinoWet. So, yeah, hats off to you. And if you're not using RhinoWet, why the hell aren't you using RhinoWet? If you're doing any sort of hand sanding, which I'm sure most of us are, it's the right stuff to use. It just lasts a lot longer. It saves you money. It's the best stuff. You can get it from Texas Ferro Supply, which is texasferrosupply.com. And as well as RhinoWet, obviously they have everything else that you need as either a farrier, a blacksmith, or a knife maker. Whatever you are, they've got it all. Go take a look, texasferrosupply.com. Fill up your basket with RhinoWet and take a look at the other stuff they've got. If you use KnifeTalk10 at checkout, you'll get 10% off your order too. So why wouldn't you, eh? Okay, let's do a few more questions, shall we? Where are we? Quantum Ironworks. Hi, fellas. Thank you for all your... It is. It's yeah, we've had a couple of long ones here. I think normally Jeff, he sort of edits these down a bit, but he's excited to go and get some food in Barcelona, so he's just dumped everything in as is, so bear with us. Hi, fellas. Thank you for all your valuable information you provide on your podcast. I've been making knives for a little under a year now as a part-time hobby. Being a husband and a father of two to a 3- and a 5-year-old and a full-time engineer, I have very limited time I can put towards this. So far, I've been able to complete 3 knives. I post all my progress and finished work on Instagram, where a lot of friends, family, and co-workers follow me, which has brought a lot of interest in buying a knife from me. So my question is, how do I handle these inquiries when my volume is so small? Lately, I just tell them to wait for the next build, but now I'm at the point where 5 different people want the next knife. How can I make it fair to everyone, but I don't want to risk losing them as a potential customer? I'm very serious about taking Mareko's advice and not accepting custom orders or deposits. I just want to build what I want when I want them and offer it up for sale. Thanks for your advice, Paul. Thanks for your advice, Paul. Sorry.
Thanks for your advice, Paul.
I mean, he's already thinking not falling into that trap of just taking loads of future orders and then just having to, you know, work his way through them, which can be really difficult. So, you know, hats off for that already. I mean, the obvious one is just make them and then post them when they're made and say this one's available, and it, you know, a first come first serve basis. But you know, personally, what I'd say is a newsletter is the great way to do it, because if you get everybody's email addresses, they all get the email at the same time. These are available. But like you said, a lot of these are sort of family members and friends and that, and they may not be, you know, may not, you know, join a newsletter, but, you know, they may be good buddies and you still want to help them out. So it's a bit more difficult that way. But, you know, it's a nice problem to have, isn't it? You've got too many people asking for your work. Sure. It's a nice problem to have. Yeah, it's difficult. I'd say if they're all liking them on, well, like you say, on Instagram, which is what you're using, just, you know, don't mention the knife until you finished it. Put it up and say, now it's available. You know, on a first come, first serve basis. I think that's the sort of fairest way you could do it, I suppose.
Yeah, I've really admired, I've mentioned the Bloodroot Blades guys, Luke and David, down in outside of Atlanta. They're in Georgia, mm-hmm. and they're culinary knife makers. They're a team, and I really admire their model with their newsletter. It's just slightly more involved, and I think, if there are five people who are interested in one knife, then it's maybe not as horribly involved. But they have, you know, thousands of people, you know, scraping after their work, trying to get whatever they can. And the thing that they've found is the most kind of equitable way to approach it is to do the newsletter. They do a drop. So whatever they built over the previous month, they add to the newsletter. They got photos. They have, you know, the information about this, about the blades. And then they invite people to, and there are forms that you can like set up that help make things a little bit easier through, you know, websites and stuff like that. And Craig probably has better input on what kind of, like online forms people can fill out. But get the information to you. And basically, like for a specific knife, if you're interested in it, then basically you have a window of, I think David told me last, they do like 18-hour window to say, I'm interested in this knife. And then you go through, and if it's three or four knives, you basically just do a drawing. And that's that one, it gives people an opportunity, as you continue to grow, people, ideally, the interest in your work spreads around the world. And it gives people around the world an opportunity to jump in at whatever in their local time and say, I am interested in this knife. And by creating a small window, you know, you create like a sense of I can't think of the word, but you know, you got to make it happen. You got to make that call now.
Like urgency,
yeah. Sense of urgency, and because you're putting that little extra effort in by, you know, doing the newsletter and letting the people signed up to the newsletter know about it first, and then also letting them have a fair hack at it, and then, you know, by doing a random drawing and submitting and all that kind of stuff, it kind of actually builds trust and a sense of transparency and belief in you as a person who's trying to make things as equal as possible. And if they don't get it, I feel like, honestly, what's great about it is because it is as equitable as you can possibly make it, it just makes them that much more excited for the next time knives come out, to try to get a hold of one. Because that's about as fair as you can make it.
That takes things a bit further than the normal newsletter, sure. as well, because not only are you putting the newsletter out first, you've got everybody's email address you've already captured. Yeah. But you're seeing who's interested on that list as well. So you've almost got like a super list then as well. And if you are using newsletters, you can segregate all these things into lists. So, you know, super users and all the rest of it. So you're getting that extra feedback, not just sending that. It's a really, really smart move, I think. It's really cool. You know, this brings me to another question I can see further down here from Goot Knives, G-O-O-T Knives. And they say, is it better to start selling on Etsy as a new knife maker and deal with the extra associated costs, or just use your own website e-commerce solution with newsletters? And I'd say maybe keep away from Etsy, simply because, I mean, there's some great stuff on there, but it generally needs to be more sort of crafty stuff. Yeah. And if you want to show your stuff in a sort of more professional light, I suppose, you don't need to be a web designer, a web developer. I mean, I was a web developer for years, but I now use Squarespace just because it's super quick and easy and it's cheap. And I've got no affiliation with them at all, but I know Jeff uses Squarespace. I think you're using Squarespace as well.
I'm using Shopify.
Shopify, okay, yeah. I mean,
it's right there with it.
Similar things, very similar thing. And I mean, for a very small monthly fee, you know, you can have a beautiful site. You don't need to be a great designer. You get some good photos. Everything's drag and drop. And you're away. And you've got complete control. But with both Shopify and Squarespace, you will have like a newsletter option. So, you know, first of all, when somebody buys a product from you, it'll automatically capture that email address and put it into a list for you. But also you can put up a form there. So you can say, you know, if you're interested in my knives, you know, just drop your email address here. That then goes into your lists as well. So you can then design a newsletter and send it out to everybody on these lists. And honestly, newsletters are definitely the way to go because you know these people are interested. Right. They're sort of hot leads, if you like. And, you know, you can make them as personal as you like. It's great. You know, you're not asking people to come to your site. You're landing directly into their inbox. And, you know, and you can have links then off to the site if they're interested. And these are all trackable, so you can see, you know, who's clicked the link to go to your website. Sure. So, you know, they're of a certain interest. Yeah, you know who's put stuff in a cart, maybe, if you've got analytics on your site as well. So, you know, they're of a certain interest. Everything is quite trackable. So, yeah, a newsletter is definitely the way to go. And with regards to whether you use an Etsy or use your own website with an e-commerce solution, it sounds more fancy than it is, having your own website with an e-commerce solution. It sounds really fancy. It's not. You just go to Shopify or Squarespace, or there's a million others. You pay $15 to $25 a month. Drag in your photos and you're away. It really is that simple.
You need to do like a workshop. Do a Zoom workshop and just set one up.
Yeah, maybe. Well, yeah, you know, I did talk because in a previous life when I had like this commercial workspace that other people would use, Squarespace actually sponsored one of our meeting rooms there. So I've spoken to them recently about having some sort of promo code where people can go to Squarespace, use the promo code, get a certain amount off per month, and I'd get a bit of a kickback as well. So hopefully we'll be able to do that soon as well, so that would be cool.
God, I can see that killing on YouTube, honestly. As a maker. Because there are so many makers of all kinds of stuff, not just knives, but woodwork. Oh, there they are.
Oh, geez, yeah. The baby crying and the dog is now... shouting. He'll stop in a minute. Just a sec.
But I could see that really being a really incredible resource for people to do one of kind of like those screen captures or screen recordings of going through and actually setting up your, you know, your Squarespace from, you know, just selecting a, you know, and I'm sure they have, you know, some of those kind of tutorials, even through the platforms themselves. But I think, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm sure they all do, yeah.
I don't know. I feel like so many people still struggle with it. Like, there's room.
Yeah. I think if you can set up an Instagram account and put up your profile pictures and add pictures to that, you can set up a Squarespace site or Shopify site. Because they got templates. You just pick the template that you like. You fill in the pictures. And with regards to the e-commerce part, you literally just give me your PayPal details or your bank details, and it'll sort everything out for you. You know, and what's great about that as well, you'll have a sort of a back end, what they call like a CRM system then. So all your customers' details will always be there. So you can always go online and, you know, log into your admin panel and see your customers and, you know, their addresses if you need to go back to them. It's all stored there for you. You know, if you're not doing it, I don't know what I'd do. You know, if you're using a system that doesn't have all these capabilities, you know, where have you got all your customer details? Where have you got, you know, it'd be a nightmare. So yeah, it's a cheap cost per month, and then you're selling internationally too. You know, that's the way to.
Yeah, and I think I struggled when I first started to understand the value of collecting that information, and it's not to be schmarmy or anything. Like, these people are specifically reaching out to you and saying, I am interested in buying your stuff. So it's key. And it finally clicked that's what that was, collecting that data, that those emails and that information, is because these are people who are specifically saying exactly that. I want to give you my money for the thing you're making. And it's just a much better way of keeping track of them rather than doing anything before to collect anything. I was just doing things through Instagram. And so it was always kind of guesswork, kind of shooting in the dark. But when you have that curated list, basically, of people who are specifically interested, so you're not shooting into the dark. You're shooting into a pool of people who definitely are interested in your work rather than just putting it out there to the world and crossing your fingers, right?
Yeah, and that's the thing, especially with Instagram, which most of us use, I rarely use these days, because newsletters have become such so more powerful for me. But with Instagram, let's say you put something out, and you know, you'll see, particularly a video where you'll see how many views you get, you'd be lucky if you get 5% of your followers actually seeing a video.
Yeah.
Whereas if you've got a newsletter you send out, you'll see the stats of how many have opened, how many have clicked a link. And it's, you know, it's quite normal to have over 50% open in the email. Right. And then you've got a percentage of them who will click the links. Right. You know, it's a night and day difference. So, yeah, if you're just starting, who was it? Quantum Ironworks was saying there, get a newsletter together, you know, as soon as you can. For relatively no cost, it'll pay for itself.
Well, when you get the website set up, I mean, you can even set up widgets so that, like, on your landing page, people are seeing your most recent Instagram posts and shit like that.
But exactly.
After
that,
once you got the website set up, it's mostly just managing the inventory, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, get a new product, take a few pictures, put it on there, and you know, it'll. This could be a whole show in itself, I suppose, couldn't it? But you know, once that you can say I've got a quantity of one, and once that is sold, it'll automatically take it off the website, so you're not getting into this situation where, you know, we've got five people ordering that one knife, and you are only got one. Yeah. You can handle all of that. This could be another show, but in simple terms, yes, use something like Spotify, Squarespace, use the newsletter facilities, which they both have. They'll and reap the benefits.
Don't use Spotify, by the way. Use Shopify or Squarespace.
Yes. Shopify, not Spotify. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, there we go.
I think we did it. Do we have something else we want to talk about or another advertiser to hit?
We don't. We've done them all. It would be a good time to call it a day because I can get up and get to those babies quickly and help.
What, you don't want to leave the crying babies?
Unfortunately not. No, I tell you what we need to do. We always need to do an after show. Welcome to the after show. Okay. Wow. What you been watching this week, Morocco?
What have we been watching? We've been watching the new Umbrella Academy series, which actually has not been very good. More than halfway through it, so you know, we're just biting the bullet and just finishing it out.
That's the worst, isn't it? When something's not good and you're like, it's got to get better, and you invest your time.
The first two seasons were fun and interesting, and it was all very new, and this last season has not been very good. We finished up The Boys, I think you said you hadn't seen it yet, right?
I hadn't seen any.
It is a gnarly show, but it's good, and I'm intrigued with the end of the season, the third season, and wondering where they're going to go. And then I don't know. I just watched Up for the first time with my kid yesterday.
It's great, isn't it?
It's
that first scene is
heart wrenching, but it is super sweet.
Oh yeah,
and I think the kid liked it, and it was fun. I'm glad we watched it.
Yeah. Yeah, if anybody hasn't seen Up and you're like some gnarly knife maker with a big old beard, just watch those first 3 minutes. And if that doesn't break you, you've got no soul.
You are such a soulless black tar piece of shit. that first 10 minutes is rough.
What have I been watching?
Good. Yeah, what have you been watching?
Blackbird on Apple TV. It's been on for a few weeks now. So what's really annoying with Apple TV is that they'll put the first two or three episodes up to get you hooked in.
Right.
Then after that, it's every Friday they put the next one. You've got to wait a week. And
I don't understand why they're doling it out like that.
Yeah, it's a weird one. I'm sure they've got stats to prove it works or whatever.
But Netflix proved that just dropping it is great?
Probably. Yeah. But Blackbird is great. It's you know, like a prison thing where, you know, some dude is in prison and he's been told that if he can get a confession out of his cellmate, they'll let him free. And it's really well acted, actually. It's really good. So yeah, if you're looking for something, Blackbird is good. On that note, I think it's time to call it a night.
It was great.
Thank you very much for listening. Yes, it was. Jeff, I hope the plane's still in the air, hasn't gone down. I'll give you a call in a few days' time just to make sure. I'm sure you're fine. Thank you all for listening, and we shall speak to you all again next week, where it'll be all three of us back in the room again. Bye for now.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big money on new windows now at Menards. Update your home with vinyl windows from Jeld-Wen. They're durable, energy efficient, and are low maintenance. Menards carries over 100 different size and style options in stock, ready to take home today. Save big on Jeld-Wen windows in store or view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more window deals happening this week now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.